Josh Young, CIO and fund manager at Bison Interests. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So Josh, you guys are obviously very focused on oil and energy sector. And this is something that is, I think, going to be a very defining moment of our time here. So do you think that the Strait of Hormuz closure as part of the Iranian conflict, is that going to be a far stickier energy shock to the world than perhaps past energy shocks here?
You know, I think the real question is just how long this lasts. And I don't think that anyone knows. I don't think that President Trump knows. I don't think the Iranians know. And so since they don't know and they're the sort of folks involved directly in the military conflict, it's hard for us as analysts and observers to know. So if it ends tomorrow, then there'd be some moderate impact and it will have affected prices for a year or 2 years. It will have been something that we look back on as a terrible period. And depending on how it resolves, it could lead to much higher oil geopolitical risk priced in, or it could lead to prices that are more moderate, let's say in a year or two, if it's due to true peace breaking out and there being real stability in the region, which I wouldn't count on, unfortunately. So it really depends, I think, on this conflict that's somewhat unknowable. And I think that helps explain why prices have been so volatile over the last couple of months, as well as why the stock market has basically started ignoring this over the last month, as essentially generalists and general market investors seem to prefer to ignore it rather than think about sort of the economic and financial implications.
Well, I don't necessarily think it's easy to ignore, but I think the thinking through how this actually affects the markets is going to be a difficult thing. Is that perhaps maybe more accurate than people just willfully ignoring it?
I think that's what you said is the politically correct way to say it. But the reality is when I talk to people, they're just ignoring it. So we had put out this white paper for Bison, for the investment firm, in February, talking about how institutions were under allocated to energy. And they basically, the best I can tell, they mostly just don't care. And they'll have a little bit of money in private equity funds in oil and gas, and they'll have market exposure via index funds, and they're really happy with that. And so whether oil goes up or down, as long as their other investments go fine, they can, I think, from an institutional perspective, choose to ignore that. And as long as the fund flows are sort of ignoring it, until there's a huge long duration economic impact from the event, I think it's possible for market participants who are sort of like off the cliff and everyone's just like the coyote running off the road after the roadrunner. It's off the cliff, but he hasn't fallen yet. And so I think we need the market dynamic over the next number of months, to the extent that the strait remains closed, to actually have the impact to make gravity felt. And then obviously, to the extent that the coyote collapses and hits the ground at the bottom of the canyon, that's where you'd see a real reckoning. And I think where you'd see market participants really take it more seriously.
So Josh, I guess to extend that metaphor a little bit more, coming into this energy shock, we had relatively high oil inventories, right? We had 8.4, somewhere in the neighborhood of 8.4 billion barrels of capacity stored, of which 5.2 billion was crude and 3.2 billion was refined product. So what do you think is the capacity or the ability of the world to continue to draw down these inventories of existing stock? And when do we really start to face these shortages?
Yeah, so I think this is something that most oil and gas analysts and some of the generalists that panicked early on in the crisis got wrong. They had this idea that there was only, let's say, a billion or maybe 2 billion barrels of oil in these this sort of working capital in the system that could get drawn before there would be crisis. In some cases, I saw some reports indicating that even less than a billion barrels getting pulled out of storage would be a calamity. And I don't know where people came up with these numbers, but my working estimate has been that close to half of that inventory could get pulled out, especially because a lot of it's in strategic petroleum reserves and strategic, let's say, gasoline reserves, various other things like that. And so those can very clearly get drawn down net effectively to zero. They may get damaged in the process of drawing them down, but that oil can get used and it doesn't affect the system. It's not necessary to keep like a pipeline full or to keep a refinery operating or anything like that. And so I think you can see another potentially billion barrels of inventories get used if we've depleted, let's say, a billion or so already. I think you can see another billion get depleted before there's real demand destruction due to insufficient available oil and products. We've seen a little bit of pain, but most of the pain, from what I can tell, has been in Asia, where it was in countries that were dependent on Chinese refined product exports, and they had stopped those at the start of the war, I guess, as a sort of a support measure for the Iranian regime. And it looks like they're either restarting them or that they announced that they're going to restart those exports. So I think that sort of gets you back into more of a true economic question and a barrel counting question. So I think we have at least a billion barrels more to go before we would really have issues. And maybe it's 2 billion barrels. Where I would differ, I guess, from even maybe the way you frame that is that 8.2 or 8.4 billion barrels wasn't a lot of inventory relative to day's consumption. It was a moderate level. And so as we burn down those inventories, essentially, and deplete those inventories through this process of undersupply, we're getting into very low levels of day's supply in inventory. And as you get down, there's a nonlinear relationship between day supply and inventory and price. And so you can see price rise. You sort of saw an overreaction initially at the start of the war and then a pullback. And I think as this goes on, you're going to start to see a more mechanical linear relationship where you see price get dragged up. And then I think you can see price, if you have it, stay on for the next billion barrels and maybe more for the Strait of Hormuz remaining effectively mostly closed. That's where you could see prices go from, let's say at that point, maybe you have WTI oil at $125 a barrel or something like that, where you could see it start to go accelerate essentially and go nonlinear, maybe towards 200 or 250 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting, let's say, nuanced point to understand what that 8.4 billion barrels actually means for the market. And the report I read that outlined those numbers was actually a JP Morgan report, which also kind of highlighted the idea that this is a misleading number as well because of those minimum or those tank level minimums and line fills. So what you're saying is we can actually draw, let's say, a lot more of that than perhaps this JP Morgan analyst was actually thinking.
Yeah. I mean, I think we can draw more of that, but I think that there will be price consequences to the extent that we do actually draw more of it. So it's there's the mechanical question of, is it possible? And then can the system continue if that's happening? And then there's the question of economics. What does that do to the price? What does that do to differentials? What's that do to availability to refineries and so on? And so there's sort of the two components to physical and then price. And so I'm not saying that the price won't get affected a lot. It's more of a question of how much does the price get affected? And then I think the misunderstanding, I mean, it's sort of funny because you pick on, you know, it could be, you said JP Morgan, but it could be any of the investment banks. They were almost uniformly ultra bearish oil a few months ago with these forecasts that oil supply was going to super glut the market and there was going to be 4 or 5 million barrels a day, 4.5 million barrels a day of surplus. And actually some of the banks in March, you could see some of their early reports after the Strait of Hormuz was closed, adding 4 million barrels a day to all their numbers, just sort of figuring that there was going to be this surplus. What you've noticed or may notice if you look at that research now is that that fudge factor is gone. And then if you look at the first 2 months of 2026, you'll see that there weren't global inventory builds. So that whole sort of their whole analytical approach was bunk to start. And so here they are with this bunk approach, right? Again, this isn't about any one bank. It's about sort of this consensus world of, you know, banks and experts and barrel counters and whatever. And they were just completely wrong on one side, and now they've sort of gone completely on the other side. And so I would be real cautious. And that's where, again, I think the sort of general perspective, yeah, you can pull a bunch of oil out of the system and it won't break. I think I agree with, and it's just a question of, is it 1 billion barrels more you can pull out, or 500 million or 1.5 billion? And I would err towards there actually being, again, more flexibility and there being more barrels that you can pull out versus what some of the banks and others are saying.
So Josh, you mentioned the idea that price is non-linear to the amount of, let's say, inventory we have, right? Is this because there are, let's say, countries or entities that are willing to pay up more, like we saw? I think there was a report that there was, it was like Malaysia or somebody like that paid something like $280 per barrel of oil that they were getting just to be able to get access to energy. So does that play into this idea of that nonlinear relationship between inventory and price?
Yeah. Again, I think that was driven more by some of the early dislocations and sort of panic buying around the initial, you know, few weeks of confusion around the Strait of Hormuz being closed and some of the specific short-term flows. I think as these logistical networks have been sort of rejiggered, I think there's less of a physical shortage still, because again, there's billions of barrels in the system outside of the Persian Gulf, and more of a question of economics. And the economics have actually prevailed to the point where there have been points recently, after everyone started talking about the disconnect between paper and physical and so on, where you actually saw the paper price higher at brief periods of time than the physical. And so everyone got so used to making this one argument. And again, it's similar. It's the same thing where these analysts they were super wrong before, and now they're super wrong about it's all the physical. And, you know, and then you get all these conspiracy theories. And now you're, I think, at a point where these things are sort of starting to balance out. You're still in a situation where you're at least 10 million barrels a day undersupplied for the oil market at the current price level and with the current constraints on the Strait of Hormuz, and then also Fujairah, the export facility and port for UAE that's outside of the Strait of Hormuz, just barely out, was attacked by Iran recently. And so there may actually be, that number may be, let's say, 11, or if you were thinking it was 13, maybe it's 14 now million barrels a day that are disrupted. And I think hopefully the audience will appreciate the uncertainty around some of these numbers. And even though they're very large numbers and there's a very wide error band, there's just so much uncertainty around it that I think it's helpful to be, I guess, directionally correct rather than precisely wrong on some of these numbers, which is generally my take towards the oil market, but particularly around this stuff. So I think the question is, where do you start seeing nonlinearity? And I think it's not for maybe a little while longer, where I think you need to see another, let's say, 500 million barrels come out of the system to see prices start to reflect not just sort of stepping up as inventory comes down, price steps up sort of almost mechanically or in parallel, and where instead, you'll see, let's say, a little inventory come out and price rise a lot. And that nonlinearity, I think, will be an indicator of the early stages of demand destruction, where, like you were saying, it's a question of different countries or different refiners or different, you know, jurisdictions essentially competing with each other for the same price, for the same barrel, and they'll be competing via price. And you saw, I guess, a glimpse of that early on as people were panic buying, and you saw an indicator of how much different countries and jurisdictions that you might not have expected to pay $230 or $280 a barrel. Some of these countries that were those high bidders were the ones that I and others would frequently use as examples of places where you would expect oil demand destruction. So the pricing for it might be actually even higher than I am comfortable underwriting to in terms of where you'd actually see real demand destruction if it has to be significant. But that's where you'd start to see that bidding, and that's where you could get very quickly from, let's say, this 100 to maybe 125, 130 world for WTI and maybe another $10 or so for Brent, where these are all sort of acceptable bounds. There's not much demand destruction. People don't love paying a little more for gasoline or diesel at the pump. But the reality is most of their extra amount they're paying is taxes and regulations. It's not actually the higher oil cost. And so at some point, though, you get to enough oil out of the system. And again, whether it's 500 million barrels, whether it's a billion and a half more that's come out from this 8.2 or 8.4 billion barrel starting point of oil and products in storage and SPRs, maybe it's, again, 7, maybe it's 7.2, maybe it's 6, but there's some number where as you get towards that, you end up with prices starting to rise faster and then potentially rise exponentially. And to I think there's a shot if the Strait of Hormuz is closed, let's say 3 to 6 months from now, where you could end up with all-time high oil prices.
All-time inflation-adjusted highs? And that's a big deal because, you know, the inflation adjustment around oil price, like we've seen recently the highest crude print, but inflation adjusted, it's still, you know, peanuts really, right?
Well, I think that that one tanker that was bought, I think it was Sri Lanka or something for $280 a barrel, that's probably the highest price, that may be the highest price inflation adjusted that I'm aware of that right. Crude oil has been paid for, but that was a one-off. I don't know. That's not really what I'd look for. It's a little like when oil prices went negative for a day, but when I tried to go buy some myself, there wasn't any available and there was no storage available. So sort of like a fake number, but oil really was $10 a barrel in, you know, COVID lows, April of 2020. So you really could buy as much of it as you wanted at $10 a barrel. You couldn't really buy it at negative 30. Similarly, you couldn't go sell oil other than that one tanker, you couldn't go sell oil for 280 or whatever it was that they bought it for, that one tanker for in Sri Lanka. That one trade did clear, but it's not, I think, really indicative of a real sort of a real price. I think when I'm talking about the price going to all-time highs, it would be all 100 million or let's say it's 95 million barrels a day transacting at that price or something close to it or higher than that benchmark price. Mm-hmm.
Going back to this idea of the uncertainty of things right now, Josh, recently, you know, within the last couple of days, we've seen more energy infrastructure be attacked, a bulk carrier as well. What are some of these latest attacks that we've seen? Is this, you know, something that is ramping up again?
That's a great question. Honestly, I don't know. It does appear that this is a new wave, right? Because there hadn't been many attacks for, I guess we've been in a ceasefire now for almost a month between the US and Israel and Iran. And so it's an open question. I'm not sure if this is one-off, the IRGC responding to, let's say, US destroyers coming into the Persian Gulf, which was a recent headline. Perhaps it was just sort of a tactical response, or perhaps this is a start of a next wave of activity. I think one important aspect of this is that it might not matter from an oil market perspective. What matters, in my view, much more is if there is a meaningful number of tankers that are laden with oil and oil products that are able to leave the Strait of Hormuz, and then if there's empty ones that are coming back into the Strait to get reloaded. And so far, the answer to that is no. And there's all kinds of reports that have come out, news reports and subscription magazines and all kinds of stuff that are talking about there being way more oil flow than people are saying. And honestly, a lot of that stuff is just complete nonsense. It's maybe worse than the investment bank reports where, you know, it's used to sell stuff, but what the message has been just completely inconsistent with the reality. So what's going to happen with the war? I don't know. It does seem like Iran's strategy is to limit oil flows to garner all-time high oil prices in order to economically pressure and financially pressure the U.S. to withdraw and to concede. And then the U.S. appears to be trying to, via blockade of Iran, trying to put economic pressure on Iran to concede. And, you know, different people have different perspectives on who might win in this sort of game of economic chicken. But the one group that I think will win, which is why I'm sort of smiling while talking about this horrible situation, is oil investors. And so, you know, owning oil stocks and oil drilling rig stocks and so on, you know, I think is well positioned for this particular scenario. And as both sides seem to be talking past each other, failing to sort of reach reasonable accommodation, and as there's, like you mentioned, this next wave of attacks on ships, commercial ships, whether it's cargo ships or tankers, I think that's unfortunately for the world and fortunately for oil and oil equity investments, quite negative for the resumption of flows of oil from the Strait of Hormuz anytime soon.
Josh, kind of continuing on this idea of attacks and explosions, we've seen, you know, a flood. We've seen a bunch of reports of explosions and fires, both from refining and export facilities all over the world, not only in the Middle East here. Do you think that this is a case of just seeing more of these, more of this information and these events, rather than maybe a coordinated effort of some sort to destroy energy access and infrastructure across the world?
So I would break it into three parts. So there's definitely a coordinated effort by Ukraine to destroy Russian export facilities and refineries. That we know for sure. There's all these reports of these drones and missiles from Ukraine blowing up Russian oil infrastructure. So definitely we know that. And then Russia has responded attacking Ukrainian oil infrastructure and similar. So we know for sure that's happening. And we know that there were some attacks between Israel, primarily Israel, not less the US, and Iran on oil infrastructure, and then Iran striking oil infrastructure in the Persian Gulf area. So I think that sort of got everyone looking at it. And I think what you're thinking about is, hey, maybe there's this attention bias on these other refineries that are catching on fire, and chemical plants and other energy infrastructure around the world, because there have been a number of news reports about these things. And I think it is possible that there's some sort of sabotage going on, because it does appear that there's an unusual number of these events outside of the sort of Russia-Ukraine world and outside of the greater sort of Persian Gulf area, outside of the Middle East. But I think the other side of it is that with very high refining margins, there's a huge incentive and very high chemical margins, especially here in the US and other jurisdictions with low natural gas prices, low feedstock prices, and very high demand, fertilizer plants too, and so on. There's a tendency for these plants to run at above their plant capacity, above their 100% utilization. You'll see refineries run at 110% utilization, which is sort of funny when you think about it, until you see pictures and videos of refineries on fire. And so this is unfortunately a reality of the operation of these things. It's ultra expensive and potentially impossible to keep these refineries and chemical facilities from ever having fires or explosions. And so I think I'm in the camp that they're just running hot because margins are really high, and we're seeing a lot of explosions around that, rather than there being some sort of sabotage, which again, a number of different folks have been writing about and reporting about. But I'm open-minded. It's possible that it's not just ultra high utilization leading to unusually high numbers of industrial accidents.
How resilient has a lot of this infrastructure been to these attacks? You know, in some cases, they seem to be getting back into operation fairly quickly, and other cases, it really takes a lot more time. Has this, you know, kind of surprised you at the ability of the, let's say, the service companies to be able to rebuild a lot of this infrastructure?
It is shocking. It is amazing how quickly refineries can go from giant explosion videos or pictures to being back in operation. I post this stuff on social media sometimes about how I really respect oilfield services workers and so on. I think it's a really important job and an important sort of set of jobs, and very dangerous and really important for society for folks to do that sort of work, in addition to other sort of similar work that we all enjoy. And we have these sort of like laptop job type things, and we live off the back of these people doing these hard, dangerous, thankless job. So I'm appreciative of it, but it's almost miraculous what some of these guys have been able to do. So, you know, I don't really fully understand it. And I've spoken with people who are involved, who have businesses where they do repair and maintenance. And apparently a lot of it is that because it's not infrequent to have these problems, there's a decent amount of spare equipment. And then there's a lot of people who are trained in the various sort of reconstruction and repair aspect. And so I think it must be that. And some of it's also apparently in Russia, some of the refinery complexes are enormous and they're redundant because they were built under the USSR, the communist system. And so instead of building, you know, one refinery, they built like 10. And so when Ukraine goes and destroys three of them or something, they just turn on the other ones that have been sitting there for 40 years and that they didn't scrap for parts, or they put back in the parts that they did steal out of it and then, or take out to run other stuff. And so, and then there's some combination of those. And then there's some real questions about how badly infrastructure in the Persian Gulf has been destroyed or damaged in these attacks by Iran as well as on Iran. But the attacks on Russia and then, you know, their ability to get stuff back on very quickly, it is truly, especially with all their people, so many of their young men, unfortunately, on the battlefield and dying and so on, and they've still been able to keep things running at a pretty high level considering how much has been attacked. So again, I just continue to be surprised. I chat with people whose life's work is to do this or own businesses that do it, and they can't even sort of fully explain it. They just sort of acknowledge that these things turn on a lot faster. And I guess the one positive is that when we do, hopefully we have peace tomorrow. But whenever we get peace and whenever we have facilities back on and export, you know, the strait back open, hopefully these facilities will be similar to the Russian facilities and others where they come on real fast and there's very little impacted, because there is some risk that even if the strait opened tomorrow, as the tanker backlog sort of worked its way off over the next few months, there's a risk that when they turn back on production in various places, that it won't be as much production, and then that some of these refineries and LNG facilities and chemical plants may take a lot longer to get back to pre-war export levels.
Is there any appreciable difference, or is it more down to the level of, I guess, injury or destruction within these attacks between, let's say, oil facilities like crude facilities and LNG facilities? Is there a difference in being able to rebound production between LNG and crude?
Yeah, the LNG facilities have problems, including that the gas turbines are all sold out for the next 5 years. So because of the AI data centers and because of this sort of demand boom, there are some real issues in terms of being able, like Qatar may be stuck for years without replacement parts for a couple of their liquefaction trains, essentially. And I think it was something like 15 to 25% of their export capacity that may be off. People have said anywhere from 2 to 5 years. I'm going to take the under on that. I figure that they'll figure it out. It's a huge business for them. And if they have to pay twice the normal cost or whatever to get the stuff back on, I would expect that they do it. Or, you know, they have some expansions that are supposed to be going on. And so maybe they won't have those original trains on for a while, but they'll have new ones on, and maybe they have extra capacity on those. And so they'll get back. I think I'm optimistic that they'll get back on faster than people think, but yeah, there's real risk there. And because of the strains, ironically, from the data center boom and from the gas power generation boom here in the US and Canada and elsewhere, they're sort of stuck in that supply chain sort of crunch. Whereas there's not really that same sort of crunch on refining equipment and chemical plant equipment and so on. So I think the availability, to the extent that it's available at all, of that stuff, it should be able to come back on a lot faster. Mm-hmm.
You know, we saw the other day Spirit Airlines has already shut down. We had major or shortages of major countries having gasoline and diesel being completely unavailable. Do you think these are just the, let's say, the first innings and or the, you know, dramatic overreactions to this oil shock?
I think Spirit was going to go bankrupt around when it went bankrupt, regardless of the jet fuel move. It looked like they were sort of on track to file. I think they had already hired some of their bankruptcy-related financial advisors before the RAND war even started. That was more of a bad regulatory decision. I'm actually very pro-competition, so I like the idea generally of preventing there being a few oligopoly companies in a particular industry, but they were just not well-suited to be able to compete on their own. They're frankly terrible. I flew on them a few times a long time ago, and just to, I mean, it's not like, it's like the old, there was this one Onion article I had up on my wall for many years. It was about, the headline was, even CEO can't understand how Radio Shack is still in business. And I think it was from 2007, but a similar idea to Spirit. Like, how is this thing? So that I would put aside. That was a bad decision, I think, by the Biden administration and by a judge who I think might have actually been appointed by Reagan or something, but still. So maybe it was a bipartisan bad political decision, but bad decision led to a bad outcome. I don't think that's jet fuel related. The shortages that we've read about, for the most part, when I tried tracking down where they were getting their refined products, it was from China. And so those looked more driven by China's export ban of refined products than from the current sort of direct dislocation from the Strait of Hormuz closure. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we've seen much yet in terms of the impact of all of this. And if anything, I follow Freight Waves and some of these other sort of transport trackers and other early indicators of economic activity as well as oil demand. And things are booming from a transportation perspective and from a U.S. industrial perspective. And so if anything, at least the U.S., thinking about the U.S. first, which makes sense, not just because I'm here, but also because the U.S. is a disproportionate consumer of oil across the U.S. economy. I think we consume close to, what is it, 20 to 25% of global oil and oil products, while we're only 5% or something of the world population. I could be off on those numbers slightly, but I think it's something like that. So we're real disproportionate consumers. And so I don't know, I'm not sure that we're even starting to see demand destruction or anything close to that. And again, I think that's where all the, you have sort of the people who were really bearish oil who flipped immediately after the strait was closed, and they're like super bullish oil and they're talking about 250, but oil isn't there and they can't really explain it. So that's where you had those paper versus physical problems. And then there's the sort of economists and some of the investment banks that were really bearish oil, and they try to be bullish here, but they're still, they'll talk right away about how oil is going to go to 50 or 30 or whatever as soon as the strait reopens. Frankly, some of the Trump administration folks have been referencing some of that work too, and they try to bring it up as often as possible. And I think the thing those guys get wrong, they'll reference things like demand destruction or some of these factors, and you're just not seeing it. And you don't have to even look at the supply-demand numbers. You can literally just look at the price. And when you look at the physical price, it's not that bad. And you look at the futures price, it's not that bad, especially, like you said, when you inflation adjust it. It's really, these are moderate prices in a world of $8 Starbucks drinks and, you know, all-time high real estate prices and insurance costs and healthcare costs that are twice what they were 5 years ago. So, you know, these are very moderate oil prices. And so when you look at that, you can see really quickly that there's sort of the ultra bearish oil camp that can't wait for oil to get back to 50. They're missing the demand destruction they're hoping for that would get them to that oil price anytime in the near to medium term. Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of going back to the Spirit Airlines thing, I saw a little quick SNL skit the other day, and they were saying that the airline actually shut down while some flights were still in the air. and that left some, you know, passengers without the ability of having anybody at the counter to greet them when they were offloading the plane, which was, you know, par for the course on their commitment to their services.
So, yeah, very, very sad. I mean, just really like a very poorly run business. And, you know, the one weird part that's worth talking about just for a minute there is, again, people will say, oh, this is proof that you need oligopolies to stay in business or whatever. But the reality is that airlines are very, very heavily regulated, and the available, what is it, jetways, the gates that they have, those are very heavily constrained by local regulations and not in my backyard NIMBYism. And so you end up with these weird sort of compilations of regulations and taxes that force airline ticket prices way higher. So it costs everyone a lot more to travel, but you don't really see in your ticket price that it's like $50 of profit to the airline and $500 of taxes and regulations and extra costs for XYZ nonsense about the, you know, equality of XYZ factor you don't care about that you're paying for your plane ticket. And so that sort of pushes the break evens way off, especially for discount airlines where they're offering ultra low services like you're talking about. And, you know, to be fair to Spirit, I thought the joke was going to be morbid that they stopped their service and the planes crashed. And again, thank goodness that didn't happen, but that didn't happen, right? Like, they were actually not bad safety wise, as far as I'm aware, because if you were bad, you would just get put out of business if you had an unacceptable level of crashes. So there's this sort of weird, unfortunate dichotomy. People say, oh, well, jet fuel prices are too high. But if you look at the actual cost to an airline, the taxes and regulations and limitations on gates and so on, which are all unnatural, all not driven by a free market, they're all sort of imposed by various levels of government that we've just gotten used to over so many decades. Those are the things that I think drove sort of a Spirit to bankruptcy and that keep these sorts of businesses from being viable. And it's actually the way to tie that back to oil, beyond just me being sort of libertarian and anti-tax and regulation, is that because there's such high costs that are not direct costs to these businesses, the marginal impact of price from a direct cost to the business is actually much lower. So the airlines have had to cut costs on all kinds of things, including having way more fuel efficient jet engines. And then also, to the consumer, if you're paying $500 to fly from Houston to New York or LA, and $20 of that was your portion of the jet fuel, if jet fuel price is 10x, then maybe you're paying $700 or $680 instead of $500, which is not great, but it's also not catastrophic. Whereas if the direct costs were 50% of the total cost, then, you know, it would have had a much, much, much larger impact on your ticket price. And so that's where you could potentially see oil prices go way higher, because with all of this regulation and all of these, all of the inflation and debasement of currency and so on, you've ended up with these very weird distortions in prices where the price you pay is almost completely disconnected from the true cost of delivery. It's like, you know, to look at the cost of a pipeline. It's like $1 for the pipe and $1,000 for the bribes and the lobbyists and the regulations and the 20 OSHA people for the one person doing the work. And that's, again, where there's so much respect, I think, that's due for the people doing the work and so little for the people getting in the way of the people doing the work. So again, that matters because oil prices, they can go way higher and only have a marginal impact on the price of whatever the good or service within the economy. And I think we're going to test that. And we were sort of on one extreme, which was way too low oil prices, which were great for demand, relatively speaking. And I think we're potentially going to get to way too high oil prices. But I think that number might be shocking to people in terms of just how high, at least in the US and Canada and various other Western countries, just how high of an oil price we can actually tolerate. Mm-hmm.
Well, Josh, I've been that guy. And at one point I was doing some work for Shell, and I counted 32 people standing around the hole watching me and waiting for me to do my thing. So I know that situation well.
Yeah, it's just gotten worse probably since, I don't know when the last time it was that you were there, but I'm sure it's 10 times worse now than it was.
So Josh, another I would say, interesting development that's come out of this war over the last week or so here would be the UAE leaving OPEC. Is this, you know, a really big deal? And were they actually being constrained in their production numbers by OPEC?
So UAE was one of two countries that actually had more production capacity than what they were producing. So they were constrained by OPEC and OPEC Plus, and they were behaving. I mean, they were cheating a little, but they could have cheated more. They could have produced another close to 1 million barrels a day. They truly had that capacity, which is amazing because all the other guys were lying about it pretty much and overstating their capacity. And some of them, like Russia, was really struggling last year to actually meet their quotas. That was one of the things that kept me bullish, even as everyone was so bearish. You look at the numbers for the IEA and EIA balances, and it just didn't make sense. They were counting on all this extra production from Brazil, which mostly didn't show up, and all this extra production from Russia, which wasn't showing up. And then they were sort of counting on all these other OPEC countries cheating. And they couldn't cheat because they couldn't produce that much oil for the most part. So, but UAE could. And so it is bearish long term to the extent that the UAE doesn't implicitly coordinate with OPEC Plus, which is a real possibility. They want very high prices for their production. Like, they may say that they want market stability and so on. They want market stability and they want $120 a barrel for their oil, for sure. They don't want 250 probably for their oil, because that'll destroy demand and is probably an untenably high level, but they want higher prices. So I'm not sure it's quite as bearish medium to long term as some of those folks that, again, have been very disappointed by oil prices going up and were very bearish coming into this, want it to be. But it's certainly, you know, it's certainly not bullish that they would leave. And then there are some other national security and other factors that are worth considering. You'll notice that when Iran started attacking things again recently, they attacked ships going through the Strait of Hormuz, and they attacked the UAE at Fujairah. They didn't attack Saudi Arabia, at least from the reports we've seen, or any of the other countries in the area. And so they didn't attack Israel, which is sort of their favorite of those countries to attack. They attacked the UAE. So I think there's some quid pro quo there, almost certainly, where in exchange for additional security from the US and additional sort of defense guarantees, and then also in addition, in exchange for getting a dollar swap line, which was requested. I'm not sure if it was formally granted, but essentially it allows the UAE to borrow money at a low cost in US dollars, sort of similar to a US bank or a U.S. state or something like that. It's very sort of an interesting sort of linkage to the U.S. federal government. So it looks like that may have been a quid pro quo, which is also, again, promising. I think it mitigates, if it was purely an economic decision to leave OPEC Plus in order to produce all of that spare capacity that they have after the conflict, because they can't produce or export any more than they're producing right now. I think that would have been very, very bearish. And I think the reality is that it's complicated, and I wouldn't be too surprised if, when all the dust settles, if UAE doesn't start producing its full production capacity and exporting that. I wouldn't be surprised if they ended up sort of de facto following OPEC Plus quotas. Maybe they'd produce a little more than that, but I wouldn't be surprised if they don't actually produce all of their spare capacity.
Because of price stability and wanting to maintain a higher price.
Yeah. And again, maybe they would produce that the full 4 million for 6 months after to try to help restock inventories and so on. But as you get in the market after the crisis, as you end up with the market back towards being in balance, I wouldn't be surprised if they then withheld production and then ended up, maybe it would go from OPEC Plus to OPEC Plus Plus, and it would be UAE and potentially several other members that have left OPEC, that to the extent UAE could sort of figure out a way back in as a sort of affiliate. I could see Angola agreeing to that. Angola wanted to grow their oil production, and they've sort of struggled since leaving OPEC. They've grown a little, but not a lot. And so I could see them wanting back in, because there's a lot of advantages to the sort of collective bargaining and the sort of oligopoly that cartel, essentially — they hate the word, but it's essentially a cartel — there are advantages to it, even if the members cheat. And so I could see them doing that to the extent that it didn't upset the US too much. Mm-hmm.
So, Josh, we had to kind of touch on this idea that the general equity markets really aren't responding as one would have thought to this. You know, one of the things that I was considering was that, you know, energy and related energy stocks are only weighted something like 5% of the S&P right now. Is that part of what plays into the muted response from the S&P and the general markets here?
Yeah. I think it's like 4% right now, something like that, 4 or 5%. It's a very, very low number. I think the contribution of these companies to GDP is closer to, I think, 12%. So they're very discounted relative to their economic contribution. Alternatively, they are growing less, at least from a volume perspective. And so while their earnings are up a lot this year, sort of longer term, their long-term earnings growth is a lot lower than, let's say, some technology companies or so on. So it does make sense for them to be a little disproportionately lower than their GDP percentage, but maybe that GDP percentage rises with persistently higher oil and gas prices. We'll see. So I think passive and sort of index composition is a part of it. I think people just sort of not owning it, even outside of the indexes, makes it more comfortable for them to continue to not own it. I have one client who is personally invested in my investment firm, but in our strategy, but he runs or is a senior partner at a large RIA with, let's say, $20 billion under management, and he won't put client money. He says, "Hey, oil's going away, but Josh, when you're doing your next thing, you've done real well. I can see you're up, what is it, 200% or whatever versus your index down 50%. So that's great. You're clearly smart. When you do your next thing, we'll put client money in." And so I think there's sort of this idea that that it's going away and that it's not necessary, that prices are reverting down, and that it's just a matter of time. And frankly, the Trump administration has played into that, and media sort of plays into that. And then this whole cadre of analysts who were completely wrong coming into this are also playing into that. Just they want to, I guess, stay relevant and sell whatever products or services it is that they're selling. And so I think people just don't feel like they're missing out. And I think what it may take is a few years of really good performance in the sector, and as well as bad performance in other sectors. And so we'll see. We're not even seeing 1 year or a few months of bad performance. We saw March, which was bad for tech, and then in April you saw tech roar back. So I'm not sure what does it. And I actually don't necessarily mind if we don't get to it. I think it's bad from like a policy perspective, and it's going to lead to insufficient supply. But from a equity owner perspective, I don't want to be confused as complaining about this, because it's quite excellent for my companies to get to buy back huge amounts of stock at large discounts and then pay ultra high dividends. I mean, life is good as an energy investor, especially if you're able to avoid some of the terrible sort of like money traps. So outside of those, life is really good. And so it's not that I need the S&P 500 to be 12% energy instead of 5% or 4% or whatever. But from a supply perspective, it would really help the market for it to be a higher percentage, because it would lower the cost of capital for these businesses and it would ensure more energy supply. And so I think maybe what we'll see is persistent undersupply, and maybe on the backside of the Strait of Hormuz crisis, we'll see some of the impact of lower well productivity and less resource and more depleted reserves and sort of a longer term oil bull market and maybe natural gas bull market too. And into that, you may see much higher share prices and a much higher percent of the index. And again, people will say, "Oh, well, that didn't happen during this closure, so it can't happen in the future." And the reality is that's not often these sorts of geopolitical things are just, it's the catalyst for a re-rating. But the real driver is the economic cycle and the resource cycle around the commodity. And I think we're at the early stages of that resource cycle. We're just seeing rigs start to come back on, and we're not seeing large new discoveries on a net basis. Yeah, there's a big discovery a year or two, whatever, but you're not seeing those sorts of large, consistent discoveries that you'd need in order to push the oil market from a bull market into a bear market due to persistent oversupply. And so I think maybe it's going to be, and again, I'm sort of morphing your question into a longer answer that's more complicated, but I think you'll see likely energy stocks as a much higher percentage of the market, but I think it'll be as a result less of this likely, hopefully temporary crisis, and more as a result of this longer term trend on the backside of this crisis, where you see higher oil for longer, lower well productivity for longer, and more rigs running for longer, and associated oilfield services equipment and so on. So I think that's the answer there. And eventually you'll see it. And when you see it, in my view, that's the signal to sell and just hang on to cash, buy bonds, whatever, because you don't want to be there for those the painful downturns on the backside of those sorts of cycles.
Mm-hmm. Josh, I've heard you say that that gold has led this cycle and that oil comes next. Why is that? And do you look at the gold to oil ratio as an indicator of, you know, any of these market directions?
Yeah, I like looking at those ratios, but unfortunately, ratios can be, they say that markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent, and ratios can stay irrational for even longer because they're not even really, they're sort of second derivatives or whatever of markets. So it's an indicator of where you're at in a cycle rather than a promise of near-term future direction. So the thing that got me excited about oil when gold moved is, one, in past cycles, gold has risen first and then oil prices followed. So there is this historical pattern that held true for multiple cycles through history, which is remarkable because oil's only been around. I mean, gold has been viable for human economic transactions for thousands of years. Oil's only been relevant really for less than 200 years, and you could still see multiple cycles where this had happened. So that was a good starting point for me. But then there was a demand function, and I dug through some very old research reports I found and very old news articles, and I knew that there would be demand from a commodity bull market for oil. There'd be incremental demand, but I don't think I had appreciated just how much incremental demand there would be. And it looks like this next commodity boom that we're experiencing, where we're just now starting to see, I mean, you saw gold move from what, 1,500, 2,000 to 5,000 or so, and now it's sort of hanging out close to that, but not quite at 5,000. You're only just now starting to see gold mines restart, get expanded and so on, and new ones get built. And those are very, very oil intensive. And no one had in their supply demand models, they all had fake supply that didn't exist, and they all had demand destruction that wasn't happening, almost all. But no one had higher demand for mining activity. And then there were other sort of similar factors like shipping activity where boats are actually using, because rates are higher, they're moving faster, so they're using a lot more bunker fuel and other refined products. So between shipping and mining activity, it seemed very likely to me that you would see oil move after gold, and it was just a question of time before you saw the demand pickup lead to a price impact.
What portion of this do you think the destruction of purchasing power, the demonetization of fiat, plays into this theme for you as well?
That's a great question. I'm not sure we've seen any of it happen yet. I'm not sure that, I guess inflation is helpful, like we talked about, in terms of, $100 oil really not hurting that much, because it's just such a small percentage of the input cost for goods and then the cost for travel and so on. So I guess there's a portion of it that's already, playing in, but I think there's room for a lot more essentially fiat value destruction on a nominal basis, essentially. So your dollar buying you less and less, that should eventually have a meaningful impact on oil prices. And I'm just not sure. I mean, oil has lagged other inflation-linked assets so much until recently that I think there's really a lot more room to go. I'd say, if anything, that sort of fiat devaluation type thesis is more in, you know, ahead of us rather than behind us in terms of the potential impact to oil prices. So lots of upside potential. Again, I think it helps with mitigating some of the downside risk here. Again, because you can just get higher oil prices and they just don't matter as much because there's been so much inflation and so many other larger wallet share categories for consumers, as well as larger cost centers for producers and services providers. And so, again, it just hasn't mattered that much yet. It may matter a lot. And to the extent that we get, I think there's a decent chance we see a scenario where we have higher oil prices and we have a potentially weakening economy, or maybe not. Maybe it's just ahead of midterms. And so there's this tendency, regardless of party, to go print money and, you know, do stuff to try to get your party reelected or to win or whatever in midterms. But I wouldn't be too surprised to see some stimulus checks, some additional tax cuts, something else coming in between now and the November midterm elections. Mm-hmm.
Josh, what do you think the world looks like at $250 oil if we get there?
Yeah, Tom, I don't know. I don't know. I want to see it as an oil investor. I was chatting with a friend who we've been trading some oil stock ideas and trying to figure out sort of how this plays out exactly. And the good part as an oil equity investor is that I'd have a lot of money to spend. And the bad part is that there might not be a lot of goods and services available to purchase. And so when you look back at what happened in the 1970s, when you saw oil prices rise on a sort of truly rise on an inflation adjusted basis, and when you look back at prior cycles, or even in the 2000s, you saw real economic problems that arose from that sort of price level. I think it would be really terrible for some of the emerging markets, and I think some of the poorest and least enfranchised people in the world would suffer the most. So from that perspective, I personally would rather see oil not get there. I'd rather see oil stay at a nice, high, stable price that would induce investment and not be catastrophic for billions of people in India and Pakistan and Sri Lanka and sub-Saharan Africa and various other places. I would like to not see that, but it could get pretty bad from a lot of perspectives if we had prices that high and sticky, especially if that wasn't with a sort of monetary devaluation. I mean, you'd have some inflation driven by that much higher oil price, but without, you know, this is assuming not a Project Zimbabwe style, you know, government just goes and increases the money supply by 100x in 2 years. If it were that sort of scenario, that would be bad too, but very different, where it might actually not impact consumption much. If anything, it could be pro-consumption to have government print money. Terrible in a lot of other ways, but right. Just to be clear, I was laying out not a sort of massive. I'm sitting here looking at the Zimbabwe $100 trillion note I have right behind my head, thinking about the implications of that scenario. But if it's just purely a insufficient oil supply leads to much higher prices on a nonlinear basis because of the Strait of Hormuz closure, the Strait stays closed for 6 months from now, let's say, I think it's just really bad. A really terrible economic outcome. I don't think it's very likely because of how bad of an outcome it would be. And it's part of why I've tried to stay away from sort of highlighting it too much. I think there's this risk, but the reality is I think that potentially both sides blink, or we end up with a much more severe and intensive military conflict to try to sort of unstick oil supplies and get the strait opened.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been to Zimbabwe on a motorcycle trip, and hearing some of the stories as these people experience that hyperinflation is absolutely incredible. And you know, this answer sounds a lot like what does the world look like at $10,000 or $20,000 gold price as well, right? It's not something that you necessarily want to see.
Well, actually, I'll put just, we don't really use gold for much other than jewelry. So the world at $10,000 or $20,000 gold doesn't change nearly as much as the world at $250 or, you know, again, the equivalent of that isn't really $250 oil. The equivalent of that is $500 oil. And the world changes a lot at $500 oil.
Yeah, agreed. Josh, one of the things that you and I were kind of chatting about before we hit record here today was the idea of, let's say, this backfeeding of crappy AI information into our news sources, into, you know, what we think of as facts, what other AIs can take up as facts now. How do you think about that feedback loop or that ability to have access to accurate information going forward?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. So we were having a great conversation. I was like, hey, let's just hit record, start talking about this. It's such a interesting spot. We're at this time of immense change. And when you look at where these LLMs are, where they're getting trained, where they're getting their information, they're just scraping the internet. And so I launched a paid newsletter a year ago, a little less than a year ago, partly because I put all of my liquid net worth into oil stocks after Liberation Day. The sell-off was too extreme, and I just decided I wanted to go do it. And so that meant that I probably should get a little bit more, you know, monthly income. I run a fund, but I'd really try to keep reinvesting everything in the fund. I really like what I own. And so, especially at that time, and so I figured it made sense to start an income stream. But part of the logic there was that as my content started showing up repackaged, I mean, I noticed this in 2022 when people got real excited, even before AI got as big, but I'd see Bison white papers or my tweets in every major publication. Suddenly Bloomberg was super interested in the esoteric part of the oil market that my white paper had talked about a month ago, or the Wall Street Journal or Financial Times. It was horrible and ridiculous. And so the thought was, hey, I'll stick this behind a paywall, and they can at least pay me before they go and, plagiarize me without citation. And then I think for AI, it's way more extreme where, you know, if I tweet something, I see it almost instantly in all kinds of different stuff. I guess having a lot of Twitter followers and oil being sort of in vogue or whatever does that. If I publish something behind a paywall, it's way more controlled, and occasionally stuff will still get plagiarized, which is a problem to figure out how to deal with that. But it's way less of a systematic problem. And I think the other fun part is that by not writing with AI, by not relying on AI as sort of a primary tool for research, there's a real differentiation, I think, similar to this sort of interview where, you know, you can just ask, you know, Claude or Grok or whatever, some of these questions, you can get an answer, but you're not going to get this answer. I can promise you. You could even like build an agent and have it say, hey, what does Josh say about these things? And I've done that, and it's fascinating, but it has almost no relation to someone who's thinking critically and originally. And so I feel like there's significant benefits to folks who are doing that original work. But I do worry about what will remain sort of in the public domain, because I think other people are very quickly realizing this issue. And I guess maybe you want to share a thought or two on that as someone that creates and puts information into the public domain.
Well, I mean, I've had some interesting experiences with it, certainly. A listener shared with me, they asked where I had gone when I left the previous show I was the host of. And I think it was Grok or something told them that I had died, which I mean, I'm pretty sure I'm still here. So maybe that's part of the simulation that I'm experiencing a little bit differently. But I remember reading a piece, and I actually wrote an article based around it. And it was that there was this, I believe it's a science-based YouTube channel that was doing some research around brown dwarves. And they had asked, they spent something like 100 plus hours on just fact-checking and researching all the information that goes into each and every one of their videos. And they had, when they had AI come about, they thought, man, this is going to be great. We can save so much time on research. And when they went through and fact-checked what the AI had given them based on the information available about brown dwarves, it was almost completely, or I think there was something like 30% of it was just hallucinated and made up completely. And then they threw that part out and they continued on with their work the way they had been doing it. And they, a couple of weeks later, came across a video before they had put theirs out based around this pretty much 30% hallucinated, completely bunk information about brown dwarves. And now that is backfeeding into this information loop. So much like you're saying, I think it's going to be more important forever for everyone to be able to understand how to sort this information, to be able to understand how to protect information. And as well, the idea that just taking for granted how these tools put together information, that's going to become a skill in and of itself to be able to differentiate. I think, you know, those of us in this, let's say, creator space that know how to use these tools and leverage these tools and become more efficient at our jobs because of these tools is going to be a good thing. But becoming completely reliant on them for your thinking, for originality, for creating anything with some warts on it, some, you know, stupid jokes about an SNL skit and Spirit Airlines, I don't necessarily know that you're going to be able to have that authenticity in AI information, which I think is going to become more valuable because, you know, as good as of a joke as AI can tell, it's still just a computer telling you that joke, right?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And again, I think I get asked questions all the time about stuff where the premise is wrong. And it's almost always like, I ask them where they came up with it. Oh, well, Grok said blah, 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 or Claude or ChatGPT or whatever. And in a few cases, I've seen people get financial or tax or legal advice. And it is terrifying because they're really good at real specific things. If you plug in something, you know, data analysis is actually pretty good. And, you know, if you constrain them to real sort of specific stuff, they're remarkable. But yeah, some, I think there's real risk around it. And then the scary part is having people come up with stuff. The nightmare scenario, it's sort of like these bots where they, you know, pretend like they're you and they like go and rip people off and steal their money or whatever. And so the closest equivalent of that is AI sort of pulling your stuff and then recreating something that's similar but wrong and then biased and then directing people to go lose money on whatever, or, you know, maybe it's not direct theft, but it's sort of close to that. And That to me has been sort of this like nightmarish scenario that I see. Fortunately, the closest I had to that was a company was using videos of me to promote their own their stock and their company. And but it wasn't me talking about their stock. It was me on CNBC or something. And then, you know, they put the text as, you know, talking about their oil company. So that wasn't so great. But I think AI, it's going to get way worse real fast. So, you know, it's something in the content space, in the investment space, in the financial space, like these are, you're seeing the confluence of this with AI in a, I think, very scary direction. And, you know, also just the odds of getting ripped off are so much higher. So I guess I'll throw in here, people keep getting messages from bots that they think are me, and I will pretty much, I promise you, I will never you'll know if I'm messaging you, and it won't be to go promote some biotech fraud or crypto scam. So I promise it won't be that.
Yeah. Well, Josh, all of your work, for listeners that do want to check it out, is, or a good amount of it is available at bisoninsights.info, as well on X at Josh Young and at Bison Insights. Anywhere else you'd like to point them towards, or, you know, let people think about before we wrap up here?
No, I think we sort of went around the world and even got a chat about AI for a little bit. So thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you, Josh. It was a pleasure, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you.